Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we talk about the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Emeritus Professor of Wildlife Ecology. Great to have him with us, and thank you so much for tuning in. And we've got so much to talk about.
there's no month busier than October when it comes to wildlife.
Man. I know that deer car collisions are probably right at their peak about now.
Yeah, the bucks have been very active now for a week or 10 days, and of course that means the bow hunters are almost as frenzied as the bucks are and out there pursuing them, and that means deer are running willy-nilly around the landscape here for the next perhaps couple of weeks. So it would behoove any motorist driving, and it's not just a dawn and dusk thing now like it is most of the year.
Yeah.
These animals are out running around in broad daylight, and they're, as far as the bucks are concerned, there's very little concern for their own safety. So, I mean, you're almost as likely to just run into the side of your vehicle as you are to actually hit them. So be alert. I think they're saying now the odds of a Wisconsin motorist hitting a deer during the course of the year is about 1 in 79. Which, for people who are buying lottery tickets, boy, 1 in 79 would be really,
really
good odds.
Good.
So it behooves us all to be careful. I don't know that we're going to get to it today, but I know there's been a lot of email and internet chatter about a recording of a phone call to a program like this. I think it was in the Dakotas. It was essentially a caller saying, hey, why don't they move those deer crossing signs so that the deer don't use those areas, as if the deer were reading the signs and then crossing the road and causing a problem? And the reality is that in Wisconsin, those signs are positioned at historical crossings, you know, areas where deer are funneled from a woodlot to a river valley or whatever, or where a certain number of accidents have occurred. So, pay attention.
You see those signs.
Pay attention to the signs. Keep your eyes open. Watch for eye shine if it's dark. And be careful out there, because deer vehicle collisions are a big deal in Wisconsin.
And, you know, we've got – I was doing a lot of yard work last week just to sort of – get it over with, but before the snow hits. And if you don't, you got the mice, you got the voles, you got the deer, you got all kinds of things that can create problems.
Well, there's sort of two schools of thought. On the one hand, at least on my property, I try and leave a little stuff up in the garden, like the asparagus tops and things like that, that provide a little bit of cover and maybe a few extra seeds for the birds and so forth. But right immediately around the house, it's a really good idea to get that mulch rake down, to put some wire barriers around shrubs you don't want gnawed on, you do some fencing. Think about what kinds of problems you've had in the past and take the steps now before the snow covers up those voles that are active all year below the snow. And once they're under the snow, you can't get at them, and they're down there chewing on your shrubbery and doing all kinds of horrible things that you won't discover until spring. So this is a good time to animal-proof your house and your yard to the extent you can while you're out there cleaning up, and get it done, and you'll avoid a lot of problems with mice and voles and assorted other things.
We had Tom Heberlein on the show a week or so ago, 2 weeks ago almost now. He's got a new book out that has to do with environmental issues and information programs and information campaigns and why they often don't work. And I don't know if you've had a chance to talk about it or think about it at all, Scott, but any comments?
Well, I've been in touch with Tom a couple times in the last week or so. I need to talk to him about some other issues. I knew about the book and read Pat Durkin's column about it. I need to get a hold of a copy and read it myself. But I certainly agree with Tom's basic premise that navigating environmental issues, which is the title of the book, is a challenging issue, and that the straight approach that I've been guilty of, like many other people, of, hey, you know, if we give these folks here's the facts, folks. This is it. It's black and white. How could you not see this? Well, that does not cut it in many circles. And when you get to contentious issues, things we've talked about a lot on the program, like feral cats, for example, people's thought process and attitudes toward a management issue like that are created by their childhood, their family life, their education, their job site, their relationship to animals, a whole host of other things. And the simple presentation of how many birds are killed or whatever other tact you take on this is not going to get the job done. So I think Tom apparently does a very nice job of exploring lots of environmental issues where a new approach is necessary. Now,
and gives us some advice.
We've been essentially doing it the wrong way for a long, long time. So hopefully there's some advice in there that'll move us forward, make us a little more effective, as we certainly need to be.
Deer season coming up in, 10 days?
Yeah.
The regular season.
The regular season.
The 9-day.
And realistically, the regular season takes on a little more of a traditional feel this year because that October hunt is out the window, which I'm not complaining about that in any way.
No.
I know I'm really looking forward to it. 600,000+ other people are really looking forward to it, and I can't imagine there's hardly anyone in the state who isn't touched in one way or the other by a family member or friend or neighbor or something involved in the gun deer season. So, yes, it starts a week from Saturday morning. And generally speaking, there are lots of things for hunters to think about. They're getting their gear together, getting their licenses. Presumably, they've identified a place where they're going to hunt, made their landowner contact, gotten their group together, all that kind of stuff. But there are a few other things. I know that the DNR is anxious for hunters to report feral pig sightings.
Yeah.
So if anybody sees a pig out there, let your DNR office know about it. We do not want feral pigs in Wisconsin under any circumstances.
No.
Hunters who have historically been very successful or have the potential this year to be more successful in terms of harvesting more than they can eat, think about the donation program. That's in its 11th year. I think about 80,000 deer have been donated through the various donation systems in the state. And that's equated to 3.6 million pounds of ground venison. That's a lot of ground venison to feed people who need the protein. So folks who want to consider that can just go to the DNR website and all the rules of the road in terms of how to participate. And the 120-some participating meat processors are all listed there so they can get involved in that. Safety, of course, is always an issue above and beyond harvesting deer. But the good news is hunting,
pretty safe.
It's pretty darn safe relative to some things that we think are a lot safer, and it's been getting safer as the years have gone by. So hunter education and awareness and I think people just being a little more cautious have all helped out.
Outlook, by the way?
Well, despite an awful lot of grumbling from some quarters, but gee, we're just not seeing deer. The proof will be in the pudding. If a good deer harvest is secured by the end of the season, and every indication suggests it will be, then obviously those deer have got to be out there somewhere to produce that harvest. Now, granted, there are problems created by the distribution of deer on the landscape, and a whole host of things go into creating that distribution. So private land generally is going to hold more deer than public land, and public land is going to hold more deer hunters than private land, and deer movements are affected by weather and hunter behavior and a whole host of other things. So part of the problem these days seem to be the old adage, seeing is believing, and if hunters aren't seeing deer, they have a tough time believing that they're out there. And I think there's been lots of information to suggest that seeing deer contributes greatly to satisfaction with the hunt. So hopefully the weather will cooperate, the deer will cooperate, people will get out there and enjoy themselves, be safe, and produce a good deer harvest. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we definitely will. And you can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question or comment for our guest today. Scott Craven, as we talk the world of wildlife, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to hear from you that way. Deer Hunt 2012, Dan Small's program is That was always a great show, isn't it?
Yes, it's very, very popular. It kind of gets people into the mindset of thinking about all the issues related to the deer hunt. We've passed the two broadcasts on Wisconsin Public Television, which
right.
are on the first and third, but Fox Sports Network is airing it again on the 8th, which I guess is tomorrow,
yep.
and on the 11th. So there's still a chance, if you've missed Deer Hunt 2012 with Dan Small, still a chance to see it.
Fred in Janesville will give you a chance to join in. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, fellas. Scott, I was up north of town over a couple weeks ago doing some grouse hunting.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a snowmobile trail and ran into a very nice gentleman who came out to let me know that he was baiting wolves for his traps just off the snowmobile trail, 20, 30 yards, and just wanted to make sure that I knew it. Being that I had my yellow lab with me. I certainly support hunting wolves, understand the needs for them up there. But I'm wondering, I never thought about the trapping aspect of it when I'm out there hunting with my dog. I'm wondering how concerned I need to be about these traps. He mentioned that it was a style of trap that would not damage the dog's leg were he to get into it. I just needed to step on both sides and I'd be able to release. But is there any requirements from that standpoint? Are there other guys who might be using the old style, you know, claw traps that I see from years back? I'm wondering how concerned I need to be when I'm grouse hunting up there.
Yeah.
Well, it's a very good question. It's also a great segue into an issue we're going to talk about in a minute in terms of hunting mm-hmm. and trapping in the state parks. But the you know, I share your concerns. I'm up there, have a place in Price County, and I'm roaming around the woods with my two labs, and given the relatively few number of trappers out there and the fact that most are very careful and follow what are called the BMPs or best management practices in terms of trap use and placement and checking them and everything else, I think the risk is actually pretty minimal. And the trapper was right. The leg hold or foothold, if you prefer, traps that are usually used are, I think there's some responsibility here for dog owners, since traps are out there and a fact of life, to, you know, ask somebody to show them how a trap works. So if your dog is caught, you actually know how to release the springs and release the dog, and the dog will go about it will presumably be unharmed. All of the wolves, for example, that are wearing radio collars around Wisconsin, I think there are 48 of them on the air right now, were all caught that way and suffered no ill effects. The purpose of the trap is to restrain and hold the animal, and if it's an animal that's going to be harvested, then the trapper has to kill it. But the trap is designed to hold it. Now, there are other types of traps that are set, for example, water sets for beavers and things like conibear traps and so forth that are designed to kill the animal, but those traps should not be available or used in a site where it's going to be a problem for dogs. So it's a valid concern, but it's just not something we hear a lot of hue and cry about, that it's happening to any degree that I think would cause some anxiety. I'm a whole lot more worried about vehicular traffic and other such threats to my dogs than I am trappers in the area.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, Fred. Thank you for calling. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, at the UW, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW wildlife specialist extraordinaire, and Joe in Eau Claire has a question for you, Scott. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about fishers. I have a friend that is a trapper, and I'm just wondering, I think they're carnivores in the weasel family, but just wondering how many there are in the state, and he was saying that he live traps them and then has to drown them. Is this common practice and allowable, and just wondering sort of where the population sits and their role in the environment.
Well, your assumptions were correct. It is a carnivore. It is a member of the weasel family, a mustelid, and they are quite common. The two members of the weasel family that have been involved in reintroduction and restocking programs over the last 50 or 60 years were fishers and pine martens. Pine Martins haven't done very well, but the Fishers did fantastic, and their population just went nuts through the latter part of the last century. And in the past few years, seems to have leveled off or maybe even declined a little bit, but they've started to turn up in the last 6 or 8 or 10 years further south into the southwestern corner of the state and areas further south than their stronghold, which is about the northern third of Wisconsin. So I would say of the members of the weasel family that I hear about people seeing, you know, lope across the road or go through the woods when they're deer hunting or something, Fishers are number one by far. They're a pretty good-sized animal. They're not that difficult to identify. They're very dark in color, so they're conspicuous. And a very beautiful animal. So there's quite a few of them out there. And I guess that about takes care of it. The notion of live trapping and drowning is a little bit troublesome. I didn't... We may have to have a trapper call in. I've not heard of that method of taking them, although it's possible. But drowning is not considered a humane way to deal with animals in a trap. So there are a couple of issues there that should maybe be addressed. Look into a little bit with your friend.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And Larry and Blair, something similar, I think, here. Larry, hi.
Hi.
Good morning. Yeah, it's just very interesting. I trap about 30 miles south of Eau Claire, and in the last 2 years, I've caught 7 fishers in coon traps, and these are all Kona bears in pails inset 7 inches.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't even draw a fisher tag this year, and somebody is lacking severely on estimating our fisher numbers. When I never left my 120 acres and caught those in the last 2 years.
Hmm.
And there's nothing exceptional about that 120 acres to draw fishers. But I have noticed in our wild turkey populations and squirrel populations that they apparently, being carnivores, enjoy working a limb in the evening and having a turkey dinner. Well, anyway, just wondering, Scott, going forward, how we get to a better estimate and give tags out on fishers.
Well, Larry, that's a very good question. It's a legitimate question in your case. It seems like the number of fishers you've located on 120 acres is extraordinary. So I'm not sure what's going on there. As I said, fisher numbers in general seem to have, they're moving around a little bit more, and they do seem to have kind of tailed off a little bit from the near explosion for a few decades. There are a couple folks in the state who could give you a much better perspective on that than I. One of the fellows who's worked on fishers for many, many years with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, Jonathan Gilbert, a really nice guy and very knowledgeable about fishers. I would suggest maybe an email to Jonathan or an email to John Olson, the fur bearer ecologist for the DNR. And they're the folks who know and can be very specific in addressing your question about allocation of permits. In terms of what the fishers are eating, including perhaps some of your turkeys or squirrels, we used to use, and before I stopped teaching on campus when I retired, we used fisher food habits information as an example of a carnivore that will eat nearly anything that it can find and stuff in its mouth. So if you try and do a little pie diagram of fisher dietary preferences, you run out of colors on the computer to color in all the little wedges because they'll eat nearly anything. So that comes as no surprise, but I think there are some folks involved in the regulation and allocation of tags who could answer those questions much better than I.
Liz in Madison. We'll turn to you next. Hi, Liz. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I had a question about hoot owls.
Okay.
Hoot owls,
about
okay.
2 weeks ago, I live in a very wooded area of Madison, and about 2 weeks ago, my pup had me up very early in the morning, like at 2 or 3 in the morning, and I was standing outside with her, and I heard this, and it's not uncommon for us to hear hoot owls near our homes or, you know, in the woods around. And there were 2 hoot owls, and they were obviously answering each other. One was a high-pitched, and one was a low-pitch. The high-pitched one was hooting out a specific beat of hoots. It was like, hoo-hoo-hoo, hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. And it kept repeating that over again. And then the lower one would try to respond to that using the same cadence. It wasn't quite as good as it. I stood outside for 10 minutes and listened to this, and it was just one right after the other. What were they doing? Ed, were they a male and a female?
Oh, well, it could have been an adult and a young one, too, but the two most likely hoot owls are the great horned owl, which has many, those are often pairs in just about every woodlot around southern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And that's the deep booming hooting sound.
Yeah.
The one I think you were hearing is the barred owl, which is mm-hmm. a little smaller than a great horned owl, but not much. But they are also very common, and they have a distinctive tone to their call sequence, which is often described as who cooks for you.
So it's kind of, that's exactly what it was.
Something like that. And
that's what it was.
Yeah. So that's a barred owl, and they frequently it's fairly easy to imitate that call. I didn't do a particularly good job of it, but if you practice a little bit, you can actually talk to the owls and they'll answer back to you as well. And they do call back and forth and get kind of wound up. The difference in tone and all could have had something to do with the way the bird was facing or the wind direction or a young one versus an older one or a whole host of things. So I can't tell you about that, but you were hearing a couple of barred owls talking to each other. What they were saying, I have no idea.
Talking about the amount of prey that's in the area, maybe.
I think they were probably, if it was recently, probably discussing how happy they were the election was almost over.
Yeah, aren't we all? Thank you very much, Liz, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. All that talk about bird song, you know, about the barred owl sound reminded me that a week or so ago we were talking about whooping cranes. We were doing a whole series of programs this year because of the 40th anniversary of the Endangered Species Act. And we were talking about hoopers, and somebody called and said, what do they sound like? And I did not have set up the sound of the hooper.
And I'll bet you do now.
I do right now. Let's listen to that hooper. There we go.
Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what they sound like. And somebody else had said, well, do they sound like a sandhill? And I said, no, they don't sound like a sandhill. And we've got that sandhill sound up, so let's just for comparison purposes.
Why not?
Yeah, that's a good sandhill.
I really like the sandhill call better, personally. It sounds prehistoric, and it's just kind of strange, but it's a cool thing to hear.
Yeah, very cool. So there we've got the sounds out of the way. Now let's turn to Steven Slinger, see what's on his mind. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I live in Slinger, and we have in our subdivision a pond. It's probably an acre and a half, something like that. And we've had beaver in it for the last couple of years, and they're doing a lot of damage. And I've contacted a trapper, and he's going to get rid of them, hopefully. That's been an issue for us because we kind of like the beaver, but we don't like all the damage they're creating. But we've also noticed that there are otter in the pond, and I'm sort of in charge of this thing, and I have people who are concerned about the number of fish the otter are going to take out of the pond. And I don't want to have our trapper friend get the otter when he's down there trapping the beaver. Is that something, first of all, first question, are the otters going to decimate the population of the fish in the pond? And secondly,
Probably. Yeah. I mean, it's a family of otters. It's a group of them.
We've seen two of them.
Well. I mean, they eat a lot of fish. Is this a stocked pond, like for the neighborhood kids or something? Or is
it's a pretty natural pond. There's lots of trees that are lying in it, and there's lots of places for fish to hide and stuff like that. So it's not a kind of an artificial type thing. It's a pretty big, and it's probably, I don't know, I want to say 200 yards long by about 50 yards across.
But people do fish in it, so this is a competition kind of debate.
No, I mean, a few people fish in it, and we do put fish in it, and we do aerate it in the winter. So there's some money invested in terms of keeping the fish healthy in this pond.
Well, it's quite possible that the otter could have a noticeable impact, whether that's a problem or not. I mean, otters are, when you look on the neat scale of wildlife, otters are pretty near the top of the heap terms of being charismatic and fun to watch and everything else. If it gets to the point that they've had significant impact on the fish, they may very well move out on their own.
And they may have done that already, because I have not seen them lately.
I guess I think they do move around the landscape a fair bit, so it's quite possible they've already cleared out. So I guess I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I think you could probably talk to the trapper, and assuming trapper knows what he's doing, he should be able to get the beaver without bothering the otter. And there are even some live traps for beaver that can be used in case there's a case of mistaken identity. But I don't think that's an issue. The beaver have a lot more potential to do structural damage and cause grief to the neighborhood than the otters do.
They're taking down trees everywhere, and it's getting to be. It was interesting having them down there. It's sort of not so interesting now that they.
Interesting kind of wears thin after a while. But for me, a few fish is a worthwhile trade-off to be able to see the otters frolicking around.
That's how I feel about it.
So.
Yep.
Okay, well, good. That's kind of you pretty much said what I thought. So.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Thank you for calling.
You bet. Bye.
And Mike in Onalaska, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, I was wondering if we had an unfortunate situation where we lost a family member, our daughter, to a deer incident, but we were looking for an option of these things you put on your car. They're plastic, and they're supposedly would be deterrents so that would not happen again. What is your suggestion for that or any other thing that you might do?
Sorry for your loss.
Well, that's an unfortunate, very unfortunate thing. But we were, when we started the program, talking about deer vehicle collisions. I mean, we were serious. This is a big deal in Wisconsin. There are many thousands of collisions, and on average, a handful of human lives lost, a lot of injuries each year, and a lot of deer loss. It's just a terrible situation, but it's a difficult one to get a handle on. The various deterrent devices that are like the plastic whistles that are mounted on cars at best play to a mixed review. Over the last, I'd say maybe 20 years ago, there was a real blitz of advertising on trying to get these things in use, and that's been dialed back dramatically in the last few years. And I think that's because some studies have come out that suggested that they certainly weren't foolproof, and if they provided any benefit at all, it was in part, at least, in making people more aware. Hey, I've got these whistles on. I'm going to keep an eye out to see what the deer do, and therefore their very observance helped. Regardless what the tones does. But there are so many different types that it's hard to treat them with a blanket comment. But the bottom line is, for the relatively few bucks that they cost, if you want to invest in those because of your circumstance, fine. But please don't feel that they're an absolute, you're absolutely safe or invulnerable now just simply because you have those on. You still need to observe the kinds of advice we gave earlier in terms of watching out, especially at dawn and dusk through most of the year. But at this time of year, virtually any time of day, when you're traveling in areas that deer frequent.
There you go. Thank you, Mike, for calling. And again, sorry for your loss. It's very tough.
Thanks so much for your help, too, Mike.
Bye. Oh, boy. George in Chippewa Falls, can we help you? Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question and then also a comment. First of all, the question, I have noticed that there's more partridge, so I'm assuming that this must be somewhat, we must be on the building years. I know that they work on somewhat of a cycle. The comment then is, I live along Highway 29. I have about 20 acres of woods. and Pink Creek runs through my property and then across under the freeway. And my observation has been, I've got a stand back. I'm not really a hunter, but I like to sit and watch the creatures with the grandkids. But what I've observed is the deer and other creatures actually will pass under the freeway. When they upgraded that freeway, there's enough room on each side of that creek that there's walkway room. And they've got quite a beat-down trail on both sides of that to pass under the freeway.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and it's the basis for actual overpasses being created to move wildlife from one area to another. Some of this work was pioneered up in Western Canada in the big Canadian national parks, but literally huge, sometimes overpasses where they essentially build a bridge, but instead of a road over the bridge, it's actually dirt and vegetation, so the animals can pass over, but also underpasses, large ones, so the animals are sometimes funneled by fences to pass under the highway, and again, in both cases, designed to try and mitigate this horrendous problem with large animal vehicle collisions. Now, on the other front, George, I hate to be the one to burst your bubble, but we're actually on the downhill side of the rough grouse cycle rather than the upswing. And we've been headed down for a couple of years. However, that downstroke has been mitigated by some very favorable weather.
Yeah.
Last winter was a non-winter, and then we had a really long dry spring, which was good for ground nesting birds. So although we probably on paper would have thought there would have been a significant decline in grouse numbers this year, actually, it's been pretty darn good, and in some local pockets, hunters have been having great success, and there are other areas where there are relatively few birds. But I'm afraid we're on the downhill side, and if we get a tough winter this year or a tough winter next year, there'll be a few years here where grouse are kind of thin, and then we'll start back up again.
Yeah. Man, there's nothing that tastes better than grouse.
It is described as the 10-year cycle, so there's kind of 5 years downhill into the abyss, and then they climb back out, and boy, they'll be abundant again.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. They are very, very tasty. Darlene in Green Bay, hello.
Hi, Scott. I know I'm a little late with my question, but in September, I found a tree frog in between a couple of my stack tables on the patio. And so I just left him alone, and he would be there. Sometimes he's between one and two tables, sometimes two and three, sometimes on the leg. And then all of a sudden, he was gone. Well, one day in October, I was cleaning out a chive plant I have because I was going to separate it. And it's in a pot, and I pull some of the chive back, and there is the tree frog, half buried in the pot. So I left him alone. The next time I looked, completely gone. I'm assuming he's in that ground. So I'm just letting him be. I didn't empty the pot. I put it in the garage. Do you think I did the right thing?
Now, wait a second. You think he's in the pot, which is now in the garage?
Yes.
Well, the tree frogs hibernate underground rather than in the water like some species of frogs. So they would normally get down in the leaf litter or duff or whatever in the forest floor or around the yard or under mulch or in a chive pot or whatever they perceive to be a reasonable spot to spend the winter.
Okay.
So he made that, it made that selection. I'm just a little, if it's in the pot and you put the pot in the garage, there's going to be no moisture at all. Frogs are as vulnerable to desiccation or drying as they are to cold in some ways.
Oh.
So that might be a little more of a problem. You know, it's supposed to be fairly mild this weekend, you know, like maybe up in the 60s. I'd be tempted to find an area outside where there's a big pile of compost or leaf litter or something like that and empty that pot out and give them a chance to find a more natural setting to hibernate than a pot in your garage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And then it'll probably be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm so glad I called. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for caring about that tree frog.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, UW Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife specialist, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in today. Questions? Call us at 800-642-1234. If you got a photo, maybe there's something you saw, you don't know what it is, you got a picture of it, we'll take a look, see if we can figure it out. If you go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, you can post a photo there, or maybe you've just got a cool wildlife photo you want to share. That would be fun to see as well. So give us a call. Go to my Facebook page. Or you can also email us at talk@WPR.org. Bev, Beverly in Cashton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. I had quite an experience last night. When I woke up this morning, all six of my chickens lay dead.
Oh.
Inside, we have a barn. We're not using it, so it's a milk house. And the only place it could possibly have gotten in was a small hole on top of the door, which led inside the barn. And the door to the outside, I had thoroughly closed. And so I'm wondering, what kind of animal would just kill all of them?
What did it look like? What did the birds look like? Were they eaten, or
were the heads gone?
The head was gone on one, and I didn't look at too much of the other ones.
Yeah.
They laid all over, and it didn't look like they were eaten up to, you know, because they're heavy hens with lots of feathers.
Well, first of all, despite your feeling that the barn was secure and the only hole was a small one over the door, on a good-sized building, especially an agricultural building, you might be surprised at how many access points there are for animals either higher up on the roof line or elsewhere. So the possible culprits, was this on a dirt floor?
No, it's a cement floor.
Cement floor. So no tracks or anything like that that might have helped?
No.
No other sign. Well, you know, there are so many possibilities. In order of likely suspects, weasel, including a mink, weasels are notorious for killing lots more than they can actually utilize, and they sometimes attack the head or take the head. So that's probably the number one possibility. But there's also raccoons, rats, had it been outside, horned owls, fox, but since it wasn't outside, I think the indoor possibilities, most likely weasel, possibly rat or raccoon. There may be a couple others too, but in the absence of any other information by way of tracks or droppings or whatever else, is this all your chickens? Do you have any left?
No, I don't have any left because they were just beginning to lay really good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about that, but those are the likely suspects. If you decide to repopulate with more chickens, go over that building with a fine-tooth comb, even high up on it and around where it sits on the foundation or on the ground, and make sure you do everything to close the access. And
weasel can get through a fairly small area.
I mean, the size of a silver dollar, no problem. So again, as I say, on an ag building, it's very difficult to completely exclude all potential predators, but you can set some traps or have somebody set some traps around the perimeter of the building to see what you might get, especially if you get more chickens. And if you think you know at least the direction from which they approached or whatever, find a friend with a trail camera and mount that thing to cover the approach, and you'll end up with a picture of the culprit, and then you'll know what you're up against.
Yep.
Okay?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of doing tonight.
Sure. If it was just last night and they think that there's a nice big pile of relatively fresh chicken there, they may be back. So if you either have a motion-sensitive camera of your own or have somebody who could put one up, you may know exactly who it was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try that because we got a real good trail cam.
Well, give it a shot.
Give it a shot.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, and shoot me a note. Let me know. I'm betting weasel.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Bev. Brian in Janesville. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I got a question. I'm a city kid, so I really don't have any background or know-how or where to go. But what I'm interested in is for two purposes. is there any kind of resources, internet or otherwise, to help me find hot spots for wildlife viewing? Because I'd like to take my little girl to experience that, and my wife is also getting into photography pretty heavily, and it would be good for her, and of course I would just enjoy it too.
Oh, there's all sorts of resources, and here in Wisconsin, there's a book that's been, well, it's probably 20 years old, Wisconsin Wildlife Viewing Guide, which features, I think, 80 sites around the state, wildlife areas, national wildlife refuges, you know, even with the detail on where to park and how to get there and when to be there to see certain things. If you can find a copy of that, that's maybe your best resource. But there's another book called Wisconsin Birding Hotspots by George Harrison that's also got some spots in it that might be good. The DNR has resources for the state parks, the wildlife areas, and the state natural area system is another great possibility. Lots of state natural areas, and again, there are directions to each of those and even where to park your car, and the National Wildlife Refuge system. The trails in the system at Horicon Marsh, for example.
Great.
Crex Meadows. There are tons of places and tons of help to get you there.
And right now, Horicon Marsh should still be a good spot to go. I mean, it's just to see the thousands and thousands of geese that come in. That's really something.
I mean, that's kind of the... That's like the grandfather of all places to go on a fall weekend in Wisconsin to see wildlife.
Just wonderful.
Did you also have a question about deer? I just don't want to miss that in case you did.
No, sorry.
I'm looking at the monitor here, and I had you mixed up with another call. But try and find that book. You might be able to find that through a DNR office, and in the absence of that, use their internet resources to guide you to the natural areas and parks.
What's the title of that again? Because Judith,
Wisconsin Wildlife Viewing Guide.
Yeah, if we can find it, we'll put it up on our Facebook page.
All right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. That was a good guide, or is a good guide. And Denny in Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. When I heard you talking about the problems, you know, these problems with the traffic and car accidents and deer, I wondered if I could get your guest's comment on something. My friends and family and I have been through, you know, 30, 40 winters, driving winters of in Michigan. And our collective experience kind of tells us that obviously being careful, going slower than you think you have to go is number one. But if you are, if you see a deer on the road, they are going to be much faster at getting out of the way than you are at trying to swerve to hit them. And so what we say is just keep going. Try to slow down, for sure, slow down, but don't veer from a straight course.
Well, experience is the best teacher, and I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, the rule of thumb is don't swerve. It may seem counterintuitive to say drive through the deer, but there may be cases where that wasn't the best advice. But on odds, you are better off to not swerve and end up worse off than hitting the deer. Yeah. Hitting the deer can be bad, but rolling the vehicle or hitting a tree or a power pole or another vehicle in the other lane is far worse. So you're absolutely right. It's best to, I mean, use the brakes, try and slow down, let the deer get out of the way if they can, but if they can't, you're better off. I mean, unless you're a really experienced driver, even a NASCAR driver who knows how to control the car and can control a swerve, and most people are not, it's best to drive right on through.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. That's worth it for everybody to know that. Bob in Bailey's Harbor, hi.
Yeah, good morning, Larry and Scott.
Hi.
This morning, speaking of trail cameras, a fellow showed me a trail camera photograph of an adult mountain lion that he said had been photographed within about the last week up around Searing, I believe. And I was wondering if that had been, the DNR had been notified of that.
I don't know. The cougar sightings and trail camera photos have well, I don't want to say tailed off. I mean, people are still monitoring them. It's still a great curiosity. But over the last few years, since a handful of animals have been documented and trail camera photographs have become rather common, some of the unbridled enthusiasm we saw a few years ago has been blunted a little bit. So people are still tracking it. There's still a mammal sighting procedure with the DNR, and I'm sure Adrian up in Park Falls would like to know about another trail camera photo. So assuming you have complete faith in the photo, I mean, that's the biggest problem for me.
Yeah.
You see so many on the Internet that are
not
credited with a certain place or time and just proved to be bogus. That makes me a little squeamish, but if you have good faith in the veracity of the photo, then certainly get it into the system. The only cougar information I've seen recently on the Internet was a Wisconsin cougar that had been moving south, I think in the western part of the state, and there had just been a couple of sightings in Illinois that they felt was the same animal. That had left the state. But in terms of a new sighting or anything near Searing, I simply haven't seen it. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But if you trust the photograph, then get it into the system.
Well, the person who showed it to me said it was a good friend of his, and he vouchsafed for it. But
well,
you never know.
No, you never know. But it's worth it's worth adding it to the mix, because what usually happens is the ones that are accurate are proven to be, because all of a sudden there's a string of them that allows the folks to actually monitor where the cougar came from and where it was going. So, sure, get it into the system with as much information to go along with it as you can dig up.
Should I tell this fellow to give a call to Adrian?
That's probably the best thing to do,
or just
email him the photograph with the data, and it'll go from there.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jim Bob in Fond du Lac. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a problem with mice getting into my older home, which probably can't be sealed up, and an older garage, which probably can't be sealed up. And in the garage, I have cars that are stored, and the mice get into the heating systems and the ventilation systems and make nests inside the cars. I've tried mouse traps, wondering how you feel about possibly poisons, because the trapping thing isn't working well enough.
Well, I hope my wife isn't listening, because this is an annual problem for us. We live out in the countryside, and mice getting into the detached garage, the attached garage, and the basement, and most of the rest of the house is an ongoing problem. And these are all the little white-footed or deer mice that are native field rodents, but they're very adept at finding the slightest chink in the armor and getting in. And in an older home that, as you say, may be difficult to mouse-proof, you kind of have to deal with them after they've passed the first line of defense. In my case, I'm currently running a trap line of 14 traps, and I keep forgetting where they are, so I had to do a diagram and a list so I could actually check them occasionally, and I seem to be getting the upper hand. So if you're persistent with traps, and I don't think you can beat the old-fashioned, plain old wooden-based snap-type mouse traps, despite the fact there are some newfangled ones, I think the snap traps still work as well as anything. So I keep those strategically located at the corners of garage doors and places where they normally enter. Now, in terms of stored stuff, like your vehicles, the other tactic that I think is worth trying, you can buy a number of different rodenticides in a little plastic pouch called a place pack. They're maybe 3 inches by 2 inches. It looks like a little cellophane pouch of granola, basically. But it's a rodenticide bait. And you simply put these place packs, as is, in your stored vehicle, stored boat, corner of the garage, whatever. You don't open them. And the idea is the rodent finds the place pack and smells the grain bait that the rodenticide is formulated with, can easily chew into the place pack, and then gets the rodenticide. So it's a very effective way to do it, because you're not spreading this stuff willy-nilly all over the place. And if spring rolls around and the mice haven't utilized them, you simply pick them up and either save them for later or throw them away and start with fresh ones. But I would think, in conjunction with your trapping and whatever rodent-proofing you can do, a liberal placement of place-pack rodenticide baits in your cars would probably help.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
And you might also, I think if they're stored over winter, I would get myself a box of moth flakes, naphthalene flakes, and make up three or four little bags with cheesecloth or nylon stocking and just use a twist tie and put one of those in the passenger compartment and one around the engine block and one in the trunk. And that may also help.
And the same with your boat.
Yeah.
The same with your boat. Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist, our guest with us until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Kind of one of the nice things about our state is the diversity and the richness of wildlife that we have here. Such a special place to live. Brings visitors from all over, and you don't even need to head to the forests or lakes of northern Wisconsin. You can go to your local park and see a lot right there. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, our guide to the outdoors, with us. He has some great ideas for ways to enjoy the environment and to be good stewards of nature. Maybe you have a question about our wildlife. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. That number, 1-800-642-1234. Visit our Facebook page. We've got some fabulous pictures up there right now at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post your own photograph or question there, and I hope you'll click like while you're there. We'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, taking a look at our wonderful Wisconsin wildlife today with Scott Craven, our wildlife expert. Great person to have to point things out for us, explain what's going on in the wildlife area. And great to have you listening in, too. I'm glad for that. And I know there are lots of questions already online, Scott. And there are some photos on our Facebook page. I hope people go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. For one, we've got a snake here, Scott.
That's a good snake photo.
That is a great snake photo. And listener Chad from South Range said, I was cutting firewood this fall and heard a squeaking. This is what I found upon my investigation. It was pretty neat to watch. And what do we have there, Scott?
Well, it's a nice big old garter snake, and he's got a wood frog about halfway down the gullet. Interestingly, he got it from the hind legs, and it's not that easy to work the two kicking, squirming hind legs of a frog in first. Usually they get them head first. But in this case, it's working its way up the frog. The frog's in a tight spot. Now, this is a bad situation for the frog,
yeah,
but it's a great photograph.
Great photograph. And then we had a photograph of a deer, of a buck.
Oh, that big buck from Minnesota?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, and I see the wildlife viewing guide is up there now, too, so that's good.
Yeah. So
there's the Minnesota buck, Scott Verbeck. Third one down.
Yeah, third one down. So go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't even have to join the page to be able to view it. Wisconsin Wildlife Viewing Guide that came up earlier, that's up there now. And also, Judith found something. I'm going to find it. Where that is. She found sort of a little slideshow, which is how to tell the difference between a wolf and a coyote. And let's see, where the heck is that?
That's a very nice picture of you on the Facebook page, by the way, Larry. Oh,
I look much younger than that in person, but...
I was just about to say that. Here's wolf-coyote comparison.
All right, wolf-coyote comparison. You're seeing it? Where are you seeing it?
Bottom of the page. It's
there
at
we
the
go.
DNR website, dnr.wy.gov.
Yeah, so there we have that as well. So you can, there's a whole variety of things that you can see here. Some great photos on our Facebook page. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show. You know, if you like it, click like. We'll send you the regular updates. But lots there to see, and especially that snake and frog photo is really something. Mary in Eau Claire has a question for you, Scott, so let's go to her. Hi, Mary.
Hi. We recently had many dirt piles pop in our yard along with tunnels, and my husband thought they might be gophers, but when he attempted to put a gopher trap in the hole, the trap was too large. What could be causing these dirt piles, and how do we get rid of them? We have a dog, so we need to keep his safety in mind.
Well, first of all, no matter what's causing them, and there are a couple possibilities, it's about a done deal for this season. We're very close to ground surface freeze-up, and that'll be the end of any digging activity. So it may be a matter of waiting until spring, and you may not have the problem in the spring. Depends a little bit on the nature of the piles. What can you tell me about these dirt piles? How big are they?
They're probably about... 10 inches wide and about
big dirt piles. And there's a hole.
Right. My husband, he thought they were gophers, so he cleared the dirt away to the hole, and the gopher trap did not fit in it. It was too large.
Oh, okay, so he couldn't see the hole. He had to clear the dirt to get to the hole. Is this
correct?
Right? And was the hole in the middle of the mound, or was it off to the side?
Oh, boy.
Let me try another tact. Did the mound of dirt look like a little dirt volcano, like kind of a nice little cone of dirt?
Exactly.
Then that's a mole.
Yeah.
Okay,
so a mole pushes the dirt out from a vertical shaft that they're digging, and you get this little cascading volcano-like tower of dirt, and the hole is underneath the middle of it, but there's never a hole open to the surface. Pocket gopher kicks the dirt out on an angle and kicks it out with its hind feet, so the mound is more heart-shaped or fan-shaped, and the actual burrow is plugged before the animal quits doing the whole mess, and it's off to the side.
Okay.
So it sounds like moles, and I guess I'd repeat my earlier comment that that's about done with for the season, because the only reason for the moles to be near the surface is feeding. And the grubs and worms and so forth are going to go deeper and avoid the freeze up, and so are the moles. They stay below the frost line. They're still active and alert and down there, but you don't see them or know they're there. So my suggestion is basically give up for the time being.
And the
reason the mole trap, the gopher trap wouldn't work is the mole's a smaller animal, and the gopher trap would be ineffective. There are some trapping techniques that people have had good luck with. We had people calling into the show several months just clearing away the mound or finding the raised ridges that the animals are pushing up as well, excavating that, and then putting a rat trap in that area baited with bacon, and then covering the whole thing with a wash tub or something so it stayed dark. And people were doing pretty well on that. There are very specialized mole traps, too, that are placed on the runways rather than those mole mound tunnels. But that's a warm season thing, and I think you'd be wasting your time this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'd say give it a rake. Rake them out so that the dirt isn't a problem over winter. It'll settle back into the grass, and come spring, see if you still have activity, and either do the trapping or use a castor oil-based repellent that people have been fairly happy with, or a product like the new toxicant-laced gummy worms that are designed for mole poisoning.
Okay.
Good
Thanks
luck.
A lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let me go back to the Facebook page, Scott, because we've got another great snake picture. This one from listener Beth said, we saw this snake at the Green Lake Conference Center in October. Seemed to have a rattle in it and got in that suggestive strike pose when we got too close. Any idea what it might be? Well, it's not a rattlesnake. I can tell that for sure.
Anaconda.
Yeah.
No, it's a milk snake.
That's a milk snake.
Yep, a harmless snake going about its business, no concern.
And with the rattle, I see dead leaves there. Oftentimes, if you've got that tail kind of swicking around in the leaves, that can sound like a rattle from a rattlesnake, I guess.
Yeah, I think the human mind, when the snake and noise, must be a rattlesnake, but in this case, it's not.
And if you look at the head on a rattlesnake is almost like a, what would it be like, you'd call it a
big wedge-shaped.
Wedge, yeah. And this is certainly not that. But it's a cool picture anyway, worth a look.
It is.
And thanks a lot for sending it in, Beth. Appreciate it. Sean in Appleton. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So now that the leaves are all pretty much off of the trees, I live in Appleton, and I was driving down by the Fox River, and I saw up in a very, very high tree a very large nest. It looked like there were some large branches it was constructed of, probably about a meter in diameter. I'm wondering what kind of bird would make something like that, or was it even a bird?
Was it stakes, or I'm sorry, pieces of wood, or was it leaves, or?
Oh, it was large. It looked to be large branches, and like I said, it was pretty high up, so it was hard to see up close. Yeah. But it looked like, you know, large branches, probably about over a foot in length each.
And this was in a really big tree.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well. Eagle? I mean, there are eagles nesting all over the place now in Wisconsin, even down here around the Madison area, west of Madison. So, I mean, first thing that comes to mind would be an eagle nest, which is a huge stick structure. However, there's, you know, osprey, some of the larger. There are several birds capable of using big sticks like that, but I guess the most likely one, if you describe it as a really huge structure, would be an eagle nest.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, and they'll keep watching that because they'll use that year after year, and that nest will get bigger. And some of them get, Scott, some of them get to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
Yeah, they're huge, and they're used for decades.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the same eagle, but they can weigh a ton or more, so it's a big structure.
Sylvia in Appleton, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a quick comment. I'm sure Scott was seeing eagle's nests. There's about a half a dozen of them around Appleton. I'm from Appleton, too.
Good.
Uh-huh. There we go.
For the gentleman that was looking for places to go, there is the Great Wisconsin Birding and Nature Trail Flyers pamphlets that are available from travelwisconsin.com, and there's five different areas, and they have maps, and they are very nice for someone that's starting out and wants to know where places to go.
Good idea. They are very nice.
I like that a lot, too.
And I would like to comment on the owl calls that this woman was hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is from Arthur Cleveland Bent. There is a sexual difference in the notes. The male is lower, more prolonged, richer, and mellow. Hers are shorter and simpler and softer. And there is a slight variation in the types of calls that they do. So,
and you're talking about the barred owl?
No, I'm talking about the great horned owl.
The great horned, okay.
Yes, there is a section, and I've heard it. Mm-hmm. I've heard the two calling here when I first moved up here about 30 years ago. They were in the neighborhood, and I watched some in a tree just a few doors down calling one night, and you could hear the difference in the calls. And they were very similar almost to the barred owl without that who cooks for you all at the end thing. The other thing I wanted to comment about was shrews. I keep hearing shrews are carnivorous, and I contest that. They are omnivorous. I have been feeding shrews for quite a few years. In the winter, they eat sunflower seeds, and I've been finding their little furrows. I have some boards down. I like to keep them around because they eat insects. I have almost no slugs left in the yard. And there's furrows coming out where the bird seed is, too, to go after the bird seed. So they are omnivorous, especially in the wintertime.
Yeah, the bigger one, the short-tailed shrew, will pop up under a bird feeder and grab a seed, no problem.
Yeah.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Lots of good information there. And Dave in La Crosse with a question next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We're doing here some tick survey work, and we've been over in Minnesota where the hunting season, gun hunting season is going on. And I'm just wondering, we're looking for an invasive tick. The common name is Lone Star tick. You know, literature says, you know, face and ears. But I'm wondering, rather than going to the registration stations where, you know, time's a little limited with these folks, they've been very helpful for us, the hunters, but I'm wondering what your experience is between the time the deer is harvested and going to the processor. If I know you're going to have ticks dropping off, but in theory, some should maintain themselves. I'm wondering if that's your experience.
So you're suggesting that you might move your sampling protocol to visiting some of the processing plants and trying to catch the deer there.
Right.
Where you have a little more time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I usually move deer that we've harvested into the barn, and it may be, depending on the weather, a couple of days before they're processed, and as you suggest, there's usually engorged ticks all over the floor by the time we get to that.
Yeah.
How long those ticks will hang on if the carcass, especially if it's cold and the carcass chills or freezes quickly, I don't know enough about tick ecology to answer that. I think your best bet is to watch the weather, and in a warmer hunting season, or especially for bow processed deer, you know, those animals often go right from the field to the processor
in
a matter of hours. And if it's a warm day, and we've had some deer seasons where all of a sudden you get a warm spell and, whoa, everybody's rushing to get them to the processor, and then I think you'd be okay. Mm-hmm. But if it's colder and the hunters aren't as worried about rushing them there, and they, you know, leave them on the in the back of the truck or hanging in a tree or on the meat pole for photographs or whatever for a few days, not worrying about spoilage, then you might be out of luck. So I guess my suggestion is to watch the weather a little bit, deal with the processors in warmer weather that when the hunters are hustling them in. But I still think, you know, as I go into a check station, especially in the southern part of the state where they want to ask some questions about chronic wasting disease, where were you, and so forth, unless they're really busy, you know, most hunters aren't going to mind another, even while they're talking with the registration people, somebody probing around on the face of the deer to grab a couple ticks. They're not going to be too worried about that.
No,
I don't
probably
think.
Look forward to it.
It certainly wouldn't bother me if somebody said, hey, you got 2 minutes, let me pick some ticks off your deer. No problem. So,
well, you know, the problem that we face is that we're hoping not to find them.
Oh, right.
And
okay.
So we're telling these students, you know, we want to be really thorough, and we don't really want to be bothersome to the hunters, but we want to be thorough. But we're hoping we don't see many of them or any of them. But, you know, these ticks, they'll diapause at about 40, you know, when you get it maintained under 40 degrees. And I wasn't sure if at that point you were seeing a lot of them dropping off. But what a good suggestion about the the temperature outside. That's a wonderful suggestion. I appreciate it very much.
Good luck.
All right. Thanks, Dave, a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, Scott, you know, we've got a couple things that we haven't talked about yet that I think we probably should. One is the wolf hunt and what's been going on with that. And actually, it was surprising to me, at least the number of wolves that have been taken in that season.
Well, I agree. I'm very surprised. As of yesterday, I think it was 61 animals, and we were only talking about a quota, basically, of just a few over 100. So they're moving along a lot more quickly than I thought. And the harvest has been running about 2-1 for animals taken by trapping versus guns or firearms. Mm-hmm. So it's about 20-40. There's been an interesting twist, besides this, my surprise at least, that they've been so efficient, is some concern that's popped up and said, gee, how come 60 wolves plus or minus taken, how come none of those wolves have been wearing radio collars? Because there are about 48 animals on the air. And I think the explanation I've seen for that is pretty logical and makes sense. So a lot of these animals that are being harvested are pups or younger animals with less experience, and virtually all of the animals wearing radio collars are
older
mature adults that are maybe a little less susceptible to the harvest. So I think that makes some sense. I think what people were speculating there, gee, maybe there are a whole lot more wolves than we thought, but I don't think that. I think we should wait until the harvest is over and see how that all plays out. And in fact, Zone 4, which is just most of Lincoln and Langley County, is about probably be closed soon because they've reached the quota for that area, or will soon. So it's been going, from the standpoint of the harvest, pretty darn well. And the other issue, maybe the state park thing is something we could be. There's still some opportunity for input there. There's been a lot of publicity, and there was another article in the Madison papers this morning of some anxiety over the results of legislation, I think it was Act 168, that authorized hunting and trapping in the state parks, except in a few excluded areas like campgrounds and whatnot, for quite a long period of time. I think it was from mid-October to almost Memorial Day. The concern, of course, is that hunting activity will conflict with other forms of recreation or put dogs at risk or other safety issues, but there's still some opportunity for the public to comment on that, get informed on it, and there's still a couple in a series of public hearings still. I think I had that here somewhere. What did I do with it? Yes, there's still, November 8th at the Fox Valley Technical College in Appleton, and November 13th at State Fair Park in West Allis. And I think comments can be submitted to DNR Wisconsin Parks at wisconsin.gov. And there's also a couple of other ways for people to get their input in. But the reality of the situation, although there's a long window authorized by that, I mean, we're still constrained by hunting seasons. So the gun deer season, which gets most people concerned, is only 9 days in most parts of the state. So although there's a long window, the actual impact would be much more abbreviated than what it appears. So anyway, people have a chance to comment.
Dave in Horicon, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. A few years ago, hunting in Marquette County during the deer season opening weekend, found a yearling deer that had its leg pulled down into kind of a hole and couldn't identify any tracks around the hole. And I pulled the deer out to see if I could see anything run out and left it there. The following week, came back, and the deer was almost all covered. Just wondering what kind of an animal would have hunted that down or leaped out and grabbed it and then, you know, and buried their prey like that.
Well,
there's alternatives.
Or dragged it to the site. How big was the hole? Did it appear to be something that could have been a coyote den or a badger den or something like that?
Well, it had the front shoulder pulled in right up to the shoulder, so it was about that diameter.
Okay.
Mm.
Well, what killed the animal? Who knows? It could have been coyotes.
Could have been dead before.
Could have been a coyote den. It could have been a dead animal that a powerful animal like a badger dragged back from potentially a deer that was hit by a car or whatever, or not found by hunters. So whether it was an act of predation or scavenging, I guess we don't know, but without some, you know, the shape of the den opening or size or whatever, and you said you couldn't find any tracks, coyote and badger seem like the best explanation because they're powerful enough to move a carcass that size. You know, beyond that, I can't tell you.
I'd vote for a badger. If it's pulled, kind of trying to pull it down a hole, I think. Well,
and they're a very strong animal.
They're very.
They're buried up then for winter consumption? Or
might. I think either one might have done that, but the badger certainly.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks so much for that call. And apparently, I haven't seen it yet, there's a Lynx photo. There may be a Lynx photo on our Facebook page. So we can take a look at that if we can find it. And I'm not finding it now. But, Scott, it's always a pleasure.
Well, it's been great. One last tip. Folks, it's time to be getting into the winter bird feeding season in a big way, and there are lots of good bulk sales right now. So, as we all know, black oil sunflower has been expensive the last couple of years, but there's some good sales on right now, kind of pre-season deals. So get out there and stock up and get your bird feeders nice and clean and in place and be ready for the season.
And here is, boy, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. There are so many great wildlife pictures. And a big thanks to Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. He will be back, and we will do this all over again with him. And thank you for listening. Stay with us.